Hello, everybody, and welcome to Seeds of Liberty podcast, episode 49. So we're going to go with Jeremy for the BIPCOT NoGov license.
Yes, as always, this Seeds of Liberty podcast is covered by the BIPCOT No Government license. This allows for reuse by anyone except for governments and the agents thereof. You can find out more information about this at BIPCOT.org.
So today we have Sterling Lujan coming in from Texas. He's a voluntarist, anarchist, journalist, and a counselor in training. He runs psychologicanarchist.com and the Psychologic Anarchist Facebook page. And we'll be discussing his ideas on the relationship between anarchy and psychology, and especially starting with his article, Lay Siege to the Therapeutic State. Sterling, thanks a lot for coming on the show.
Hey, man, thanks a lot. Thanks for having me, Danilo. You guys are all awesome. Love your show.
Well, I love your Bitcoin articles and all the stuff you put out, man. You know,
man, I appreciate it.
I appreciate you answering my Bitcoin question earlier.
Oh, yeah, no problem. That's my pleasure. My pleasure. Maybe we can even jump into that a little later. We'll see if time permits.
Hopefully, maybe.
Yeah, I've known you for like 2 years, and I've never spoken to you, so it's nice to finally speak. We work so closely on your page, and you know, when you transition from Turncoat to this one, and you've been growing it like really well, very nicely. I see you've been putting a lot of effort into it, which is you know, what happens when you work when you put effort, you grow and you get results, right? So
right on.
You didn't ask the government for favors.
it's pure spontaneous order.
See that? Awesome. So yeah, so go into a little bit about your background with psychology and anarchy, and you know, what's the link that you see between the two?
Sure, I just cover it real briefly. When I became an anarchist, one of the first people that I came into contact with, a lot of you guys may be able to resonate with this, was Stefan Molyneux, right? So I have to credit Stefan. As a disclaimer, I'm not a real big fan of his to this day, because he's had a few what I call ideological shifts. So I can't agree totally with his position, but I do credit him with being one of the first libertarian / anarchist thinkers to really bring psychological thinking into the fray, especially the whole notion of peaceful parenting. I think it's fair to give him some credit for that. Rothbard and some of these other guys might have talked briefly about it, but not to the extent as he did. So. Anyway, I shifted over to an anarchist, I started watching his videos, sort of became accustomed to his psychological perspective. I was already in school at that time getting my bachelor's degree in psychology. After I received my degree, I continued reading, continued studying, you know, I stayed on the beaten path of anarchism. And just over the last year, I finally decided after a 2-year hiatus, I decided to start getting my master's degree in psychology. And at some point, I started to have some thinking, some thoughts that Molyneux maybe wasn't, I want to say that he was just psychologizing rather than bringing a clinical experience and some more of the research based aspects into the fray, you know, notwithstanding all the people that he's interviewed.
Well, his main thing is philosophy, right? You
know? Correct. So, yeah, he kind of touches on a little bit of everything. Anyway, so some of my initial ideas were, and this is where how the psychologic anarchist sort of came into existence. I started thinking there has been no one that has really synthesized and integrated aspects of anarchism and psychotherapy and clinical counseling. So it's a very specific aspect of it. And this is different because it literally requires me to create a theory and a set of principles to apply in the counseling scenario, right? So in the counselor's room, I would need to work with people directly, and I would need to develop my theory based on those ideas. And just to bear in mind, this is still some history. This isn't even getting into the idea of the problems with psychiatry. But this is sort of how I see it. I love the idea of counseling and helping people in what Freud called talk therapy, right? I really do believe one of the best ways to actually help people is to have, sit down and have discussions and be able to empathize and connect with people, right? And that's not something that modern psychiatry sort of does at all. They have this mechanistic and reductionistic model of human behavior, and that's just to say that everything that that we do behaviorally that is seen as a negative or distressful is it's bad and it's faulty, and it's based on either bad wiring, genetics, or a chemical imbalance in the brain, right? Mm-hmm. So that's sort of where I really came into play with this idea of psychological anarchist. I want to really adopt anarchist principles to psychotherapy and help people from that perspective, because I believe that the way that we've learned to sort of think, to break down cognitive dents is really beneficial and really helpful for getting people not just to understand our position, but for them to live their life with less distress, less anxiety, more happiness, because I think breaking down those, not only the illogical thoughts, but also being able to actually connect with other people and to understand them from a peaceful and voluntary position is a very powerful motive for living and being more happy, right? It's to me, it's the crux of passion. So that's kind of what I tried, what I've been trying to do with the synthesis, and right now I'm just calling it neuro-liberty therapy. So, and that's, go ahead.
To me, it's what you're touching on seems to me like what I did in myself is I eliminated the fear of of a stateless society out of my body. You know, it doesn't scare me anymore. Not really that it scared me at the beginning of when I started reading into this stuff or anything like that, but the after I read this stuff, that fear did set in. It's like, well, how would the road really be built? It's like,
right.
So you got to conquer those fears and get those contradictions out of your head. And I think teaching people how to do that is very key. And approaching this from a psychological aspect is amazing. I really think this is cool.
Right. Yeah. To me, it's helped me in so many different ways as far as with my relationships. There's some relationships that are obviously difficult when you're, but that's if you approach it from the standpoint of everybody else is wrong and I've got to berate them every step of the way. And that's an understandable sentiment because that's what we feel that we need to do in order to push, push over to the other side to get everybody involved in anarchism. I just don't think that we're sort of doing it in the appropriate way. I don't think we're really trying to empathize and connect with people on a visceral and a base level. And that's I'm generalizing a little bit. And it's I'm also getting off topic a bit, but that is essentially the idea of neuro-liberty therapy. I haven't brought all the principles together and I haven't really, because I haven't had a chance to actually sit down with people and start bringing it into complete fruition. So it's just I can envision it. It's theoretical. And there's, of course, some problems that I'm going to have to contend with, right? There's an ethical consideration. You're not supposed to get into the counselor's room and tell other people how they should live their lives or even provide them with my principles. But here I have an argument to psychologists and counselors when it comes to that. Obviously, feminism is actually a theoretical position that people use, that counselors use right now. And if anything is trying to promote your agenda and push your social justice warrior material onto other people, in the counseling scenario, feminist theory would do that. So I think that if feminists can have a psychological or psychotherapeutic theory, then anarchists should be able to have the same thing. So that's what doesn't exist yet. What I'm trying to build and create.
If they're going to propagandize, why is it bad for us to as well? And That was why I shifted my attitude on a lot of things a while back, because everyone wants to get into this debate, you're not doing anarchy right, and I'm like, this is pointless. The only way to do anarchy right is someone who doesn't want a leader, or not a leader, but a ruler, and, that's it. All this other stuff is we're wasting time, energy, and resources debating on things that don't matter,
Right.
you know, what I love about what you do is that, you know, how everybody comes to anarchy and voluntarism from a different perspective, right? Some people are rappers, some people are authors, some people, you know, have blogs. You know, some people are professors, or you know, in college, or history professors, let's say, you know, and you come at it from the psychological perspective, and you know, you bring it into the counseling room, you know, with the patient or the client, you know, relationship, and like you said, you know, I don't look at it as like trying to indoctrinate them, but just, you know, just I guess the way you talk, and you know, the way that you communicate with person, I think they can pick up on the ideas of non-aggression, property rights, self-ownership, you know, not by telling them about them, but just by you describing things from your perspective. I think that's how people would pick up on it.
Right. And then, of course, there's that. It's also just the relationships that the counselors inevitably have to develop with their clients. It's supposed to be based on communication, empathy, active listening. And if one thing that anarchists, in my perspective, actually want, it's the ability to connect with other people. We know that statism essentially starts at home. A lot of us have had really shitty childhoods in a lot of ways. A lot of people, of course, don't want to admit that through either being spanked or hurt. There was this book by Alice Miller called For Your Own Good, and she talked about how one of the things that we're originally taught in childhood by our parents is how not to feel, right? So if you acted out as a child, how many times have you been told to shut up, don't feel that way, you're not allowed to be angry at me? So we understand that in childhood, that our ability to relate with other people was essentially broken. So that's why, in my perspective, the counseling environment in regards to helping people heal with the philosophy of anarchism, with the philosophy of being able to relate with compassion to one another, is so supremely important, right? That is really the crux of it. And I guess how we move on from there, one of the things that pisses me off about modern psychiatry and psychology is that they've moved away from this interpersonal aspect. They've moved away from this ability, this idea that we should connect with each other. And then the problems that we have aren't, they're not diseases. They're not illnesses. Our brains aren't broken. We had shitty childhoods, shitty environments. The nurture levels that we had as children were horrible, as we talked about. So, not treating people as robots and trying to evade this idea that our environments and our relationships have anything to do with our development is just a sad, sort of a sad part of modern psychiatry, industrial psychology is what it's been called. So that's what I'm hoping to do in the professional spheres is sort of get counselors, other professionals involved in changing the paradigm, you know, fomenting this paradigm shift in counseling. And there's another point to that. There are like regular counselors, mental clinical health counselors, and social workers, they do tend to behave in regards and counsel in regards to the interpersonal aspects, the relational aspects, whereas the big problem recently promoting the medical model has been industrial psychiatry, right? They're wanting to pass out all these pharmaceutical cocktails in order to try to heal people, and that stuff's been complete. Most of those compounds are horrible for you, especially in the long term. So that's what we're, you know, what we all got to try to get away from and just completely abolish, unmake psychiatry, as I call it.
Okay. Yeah. I can agree with that because we talked a little bit before we started the show. I have an intimate relationship with this issue. I don't have the professional background or the study, you know, the research background that you have in this, but when I was younger, I was one of those kids that was diagnosed of having all sorts of problems, and I became a guinea pig. I went through a few year period in my, I guess, mid-teen, 16 to 19, somewhere in that neighborhood, where I was on like a litany of different drugs. And it was just literally just throwing whatever they could at me just to see what would work. You know, I was, it was just, I would, they just, I mean, from, Prozac, which I think it was in there, because that was an 80s drug, right? Or 90s, or early 90s when that first officially?
Right.
Whenever that was.
Right.
Yeah, yeah. So I was one of the original test. I was one of the first thousand or couple thousand people
taking,
on that.
Ritalin, the first OG Ritalin, yeah.
I was on tranquilizers, they put me on tranquilizers, I mean lithium, like all this different stuff. And it was, instead of trying to talk to me and get me to figure out what was, you know, I mean, they did that too, but it was just, this was their quick fix. And this is how a lot of the doctors were trained, you know, just, it's literally what it is. I mean, the DSM, is that what the psychiatry book, the cut, how often do they revise that? Every couple of years, or is it every year? Or,
right. No, I forget the exact time. It's every several years, though.
Yeah, every like three to five. So yeah, whatever. And it every year, you know, every new revision, there's just all these new diseases that just came up, and it always bugged me because it just didn't make sense. Where are they coming up with all these things? Are they literally just making stuff up? I mean, that's what I thought for the longest time. And then when I started looking into it, and then when I got off all the drugs and started realizing what kind of effects they have, I started to think, well, wait a minute, maybe they really are just making this stuff up. And you know, it's, there's an entire generation of mostly, young boys that were subjected to this because, you know, we were told that, you know, our being boys was all of a sudden a bad thing, you know,
right.
ADHD and all this stuff. And, you know, this explosion of, oh yeah, well, you know, they shouldn't be acting like this. What do you mean we shouldn't be acting like this? We're stuck in, we're for the most part, most of us were stuck in these institutions of quote unquote learning where you're forced to sit at a desk for, you know, however many hours a day. I mean, yes, you're allowed to get up and walk around occasionally, but whatever. But, like, you're stuck in these rooms and you're forced. Like, boys especially just want to run. They want to do things. They want to build things. They want to climb. Like, you know, putting anybody in that scenario is just, it's detrimental to them. And instead of recognizing that, it's, well, no. Well, we can fix this. Let's just give them drugs, and we'll make them all zombies, and then that way we continue
right.
with business
as usual. It takes less responsibility off the parents' shoulders, right? The parents are like, ooh, this is the easy way out. This fixes my problem. I don't have to put any effort into this. Just make sure little Timmy chokes down his pill.
Yeah, but right? I was just going to say, I don't think it's always the parents, though. I mean, I'm not absolving my parents of a lot of the mistakes they did make with me. I'm not, you know, but in this issue, I really think they got talked into it, you know, and I've seen it happen since then. Because again, you know, just like anything else, just like the state in general, people are brought, you know, like you were saying before, how statism starts at home. People are conditioned to think that the experts have the answers. You can't possibly know because you're not an expert. So if the expert says this, well, then that must be the case. So many people just have that go along to get along mentality, and they don't want to rock the boat. They don't want to hurt. I don't think a lot of parents want to hurt their children. I mean, I'm sure there are ones that there are sociopaths that have kids that don't really care, I'm sure. But I think on the whole, a lot of parents just wanted to do what's best for them, and they were too afraid to speak up.
Right. You know? Yeah. So yeah. And I actually identify with what you're saying, because when I was young, I was also diagnosed with ADD. I wasn't put on a cocktail, feels like you were, for your quote unquote condition, but yep. I was given, methylphenidate, which is the active compound in Ritalin, which is, it's just basically a meth mixture. It's quasi, I mean, it pretty close chemically to methamphetamine, not exactly the same, slower release. And it's, you know, over a longer time span. But here's the thing with psychiatry from square, this is kind of a little bit of the history of how this all went down. Okay, originally, you know, Freud obviously started with psychotherapy, and his ideas were generated because of this, during the time what they called hysteria. These women would be in these hysteric moments, and he was one of the first people to characterize. You know, Freud was fond of using a lot of metaphors, so he initially characterized these problems as neurosis or pathologies. And so from that moment, this idea that our problems of everyday living, or I like to call it psychache, has perpetuated itself on through the times. And then around the same time as Freud, there was an individual by the name of Emil Kraepelin, and he was one of the progenitors of what we now call the DSM. This guy initially called, for instance, schizophrenia, dementia praecox, right? And what he was really known for is actually wanting to call these problems brain problems or actual neurological conditions, even though what we were seeing is just people's behavior, people's reaction to their environments, reaction to their settings, reactions to authoritarianisms, very common things. And then as this stuff continued to snowball, the DSM was eventually created. And then this is the important part of history, though. In the 1980s, the DSM-3 came out. And before the DSM-3 came out, there was all kind that they initially had all kinds of different causes, or there were ideas of causes behind these mental disorders. But this is where it really changed to where it was a disease process. It was DSM-wise, and that's really the best way to go about treating this issue. But during that time period, from the 60s up to the 80s, psychiatry was under a lot of pressure from different movements. Lange, a little bit before that, the psychiatrist Lange, he was really speaking out against psychiatry. He was a psychiatrist, Dr. Thomas Sawes, after the name of my I've mirrored a lot of my work off of his, and it's very powerful.
Dr. Thomas
Sawes, right? He was a Jewish psychiatrist and a libertarian. And he was known for writing the book in the 70s, The Myth of Mental Illness. But it was these guys. There were movements, especially from the homosexual classes, because homosexuality was in the DSM early on. So yeah. Psychiatry was initially being called a big, huge fraud and a scam. And it's got to be, because if you look at it in retrospect, how crazy it is. People calling these mental disorders in the DSM diseases. Well, was homosexuality a disease? No, I don't think that anybody in their right mind is going to consider that, a positive fact. And then if we go a little bit further back, in the later 1800s, I believe there's an individual by the name of Samuel Cartwright, and he came up with this disease called a drapetomania. And what this mental illness or disease was, it caused slaves to flee captivity. Right, African American slaves to flee captivity, and his cure, his alleged cure for this was a sound beating for the slaves, and this would help try to alleviate their so-called mental illness. So this is kind of the really rough and brutish history of clinical psychiatry. Of course, Cartwright was way before everything else came along here, but I mean we can look at the similar cases today. We have things like obviously ADD, ADHD in the DSM, conduct disorder in the DSM. I don't think that anybody who's really honest would consider that depression or bipolar disorder are actual diseases. And of course, we can segue here, and we can start talking a little bit about the science behind this stuff if you guys want to. So,
sure.
So sort of the main theories. There's three main theories. One that I'm most familiar with and the one that's most popular, of course, is the chemical imbalance theory. Psychiatry since the 60s and the 70s into the 80s have been really perpetuating this idea that mental illness is caused by chemical imbalance, depression. The less serotonin that you have, the more likely you are to be depressed. Schizophrenia, the higher levels of dopamine that you have, the more likely you are to be psychotic. But here's the thing. I'll use depression as an example for the sake of time. We can talk about schizophrenia some too. But with depression, this idea that the low serotonin levels causes depression has not been fleshed out with the research. And there's a few reasons why that is. First of all, you can ask anybody who goes to see a psychiatrist. You can't walk into a psychiatrist's office, say, "Doc, I can't move. I lay in my bed all day. I'm feeling down and depressed. I don't want to talk to anybody." You can't go in there and tell them that, and they're gonna say, "Okay, let me give you this blood test. Why don't you piss in this cup, and I'm gonna tell you if your serotonin levels are out of whack." No, that's not the case at all. They do not have the tools to do that. There is no diagnostic objective measure to say that serotonin is actually imbalanced in the brain, at least nothing that a psychiatrist is going to be able to use in an office in a clinical situation like that, right? The only way that they've tried, this is how they've tried to sort of manufacture proof that that mental illness, especially depression, actually exists. They've done a metabolite test on the serotonin metabolites, which is called 5-HIAA, right? And what it does, it collects in our cerebral spinal fluid, and they've actually they've done some studies where they've injected depressed groups and control groups and pulled out some of that 5-HIAA, and they tried to make comparisons in the research study to see if the group that should be depressed was depressed, or the control group, who was usually clinically healthy populations, were not depressed. And most of all of the studies came out inconclusive, or the statistically significant factors were not they were confounded by other variables. But one of the main things that we've seen is that it didn't pan out. And obviously, if it didn't pan out, then there's no way that psychiatrists can actually test a mental illness, or, you know, for depression, the mental illness in psychiatric settings. Then they're standing on really shaky ground as far as believing it, what they call the biogenic aiming theory of depression, which is the serotonin issues.
So it's just pseudoscience, basically.
Oh man, absolutely, and it's all happened because of this. This is another conversation, but it's all happened because of this corruption between the state, between psychiatry, and between big pharma. And I don't mean to conspiratorialize this stuff. It's just the nature of what happens in these power structures, right? All these guys, they get together, scratch each other's back. There's a lot of money to be made in selling pills to people, especially with these long-term, you know, end prognostic goals. So as you see, it's a really big, it's a big clusterfuck.
Still killing it right now.
Yeah, I mean, it's a huge clusterfuck. And when you get into looking at what these drugs actually do, there's some evidence that the antidepressant class of chemicals actually causes suicidal ideations, right? Causes people to become suicidal, which is the antithesis of what psychiatry is claiming to do by feeding people these pills. And there's psychopharmacological reasons why that's happening. And the main thing is when people take these drugs, the brain has compensatory effects that actually creates extra receptors in that particular brain, those particular brain regions, and basically cascades and can actually cause, you know, the quote unquote chemical imbalance that they were supposed to have in the first place, or cause other problems that could potentially be neurological, where some of these thoughts and these ideas may stem from. So if you want if you think you have depression and you go to the psychiatrist's office, if you didn't have depression before, you probably will have depression as a result of toxicity right. from drugs and compounds. So, and the case is even worse, and it's even clearer with the antipsychotic medications. The clinical trials and reports are very clear that in the long term, these chemicals can actually cause some of the psychotic symptoms that they claim to see in people with schizophrenia, and not to mention they can cause what they call tardive dyskinesia. So it's a huge problem, and it all stems kind of going back and putting everything into a circle. The reason why counseling and sort of sticking to these relational ideas is so important is because these methods are, we know that. For the most part, we know that we can help people with counseling. The evidence does seem to suggest that. And we do know that we're not going to hurt a person neurologically or poison them. And this is one of the main tenets of any kind of counseling or any kind of psychiatry that a person's doing, is this idea of non-maleficence. This idea that we're not going to cause harm to our clients and patients. Ironically, of course, psychiatry, by handing these pills out, you know, by the dozens, is really causing a lot of problems, hurting a lot of people. So,
yeah,
that's a little spiel.
Oh, I agree.
Yeah,
it's all about the profits for these drug companies. It's ridiculous.
Well yeah, because I was going to say that seems to be, I mean, at least when you look at it, even just from a cursory glance, the something behind big pharma in general, not even, you know, just with not even with just the psychiatric drugs, just any drugs, you know, it's the supposed cure is often worse than the disease. I mean, you see any commercial for any drug that they put out there, and they have that, you know, ridiculously long speeded up disclaimer at the end with all the possible, you know,
may cause your soul patch fall off.
Well, exactly. It's like, you know,
that would be a tragedy.
Right.
But yeah, it's scary, and it's unfortunately it just comes back to that, I guess, quick fix thing where people think they can speed up the process and just throw money or pills or whatever at the problem and it'll go away.
So right. let me ask you, Sterling, because sure. I've seen you make posts on Facebook when you talk about how mental illness does not exist in the way that most people think it exists, like depression, for example. And then people have a really visceral response to that, saying, how dare you say my depression doesn't exist? By you saying it doesn't exist, doesn't say I'm not depressed right now. And so what do you say to those people that get angry for saying such a statement like that?
Right. Yeah, it's very difficult to level with them when they're automatically in that really high, stressed out, anxious, and volatile state of mind. But what I really try to tell them is that I'm not trying to be negative. I'm not trying to say that you don't suffer, right? I'm not trying to say that you don't have problems, that your relationships aren't difficult, that your environment is not a struggle. You know, life is not easy for any of us. This is a very strange experience that we all get to share together, and it's tough at times. So in my belief is that your brain is not diseased. So I'm actually here offering the positive notion that you can recover from your problems of living. You can recover from your issues, right? So, and what psychiatry is saying is sort of the opposite. It's sort of this idea that if you have a mental illness, you're actually diseased and sick, and so and it's a pathologizing label that creates a self-fulfilling prophecy that lends credence to the idea that people are going to try to sort of live out these negative labels, right? They're going to confirm these labels in their behavior, right? So that's kind of what I try to tell people. I try to.
I've never looked at depression as like pseudoscience. Like I've never thought of it. That's a confirmation bias, I guess.
Well.
I mean, it's just, and this is another discussion. There's a whole semantic sort of trickery when it comes to talking about, mental illness, and it's a semantic discussion that we definitely have to have because one of the cornerstones of psychiatry here, and Danilo, this goes into what you were saying as well a minute ago with how I try to help people out. When people think that they have a mental illness, they do think that their brain is diseased, but the problem here is. Mental illness, the terms mental obviously comes from the word mind. An illness, obviously it refers to a pathology, a physical pathology like a disease. So, but the semantic problem here is that a mind is an abstraction. A mind is like, for us, it's an emergent process, right? It's or an epiphenomenon of brain functioning. And so what happens is that a mind cannot be diseased pathologically in the same way that a body can be diseased, right? A mind can't get cancer. A mind can't get AIDS. A mind can't get an infection, right?
I like to compare it to consciousness, right? Consciousness can't get an infection, right?
Right, yeah. If
you're comparing the mind to, like, consciousness, because I consider the mind or the consciousness to be, like, essentially the operating system of the body. It's got very proprietary software. It's hard to hack.
Right, right. That's a good way to look at it, Dave. Yeah. You can't, and that's been a big problem. They use the psychiatry, and I don't think, again, it's not conspiratorializing or think that they're doing it on purpose, but it's kind of just how this situation has evolved from square one. But when you tell people they have a mental illness, they don't even think about, and most people are confused. They don't, because they were told different things by different psychiatrists, by different people, and no one really has a bead on what exactly a mental illness is. Some people will say it's organic in nature, that it's the brain causes it. Others will say, well, of course, this is what I'm saying essentially, that the problems are environmental and nurtural. But you see, the problem here is those that most people have been misled by psychiatry to think that it's an actual brain problem. But obviously, mental illness is a sort of a chicken shit word used to sort of evade what the actual issue is, because a mind obviously can't be diseased. But then when you start talking about the brain being diseased, then when that happens, you can ask for evidence. Well, where's your actual evidence that the brain is diseased, that depression is actual disease? And of course, this, you know, to digress, goes back to the chemical imbalance issue, there not being any evidence there. So it's a way for people to sort of dance around the problem without actually addressing it. And then it makes people believe that, of course, that they're really sick and causes all kinds of problems. It also exacerbates entitlement mentalities and those types of things when people.
So you think psychology is just like a wing of like snake oil salesmen? Like that's, they're essentially doing the same thing?
Psychiatry for them, for a good portion of it. But that's, and a lot of that comes from a lot of these. And this happened back in the 60s and 70s when psychiatry was under fire. Psychiatrists really want to don the white coat, as Robert Whittaker calls it. They really want to see themselves as medical professionals. And it's embarrassing to have your field shamed like that for not being an actual science. So these guys have started, psychiatrists have started to sort of crusade for their field and to make it look as relevant as possible over the years and to make it look like they're actual doctors, which was also the reason why the DSM-3 was sort of put into place in the 80s. And you can see Robert Whittaker and some of these other guys talk about it. And I want to put this plug in now before I forget, so people don't know that I'm just pulling all of this information out of my ass, because that does happen a lot of times with these kind of issues. So there's a few books, really good books on this topic. Thomas Sawes has written two. They're dated. I recommend reading those first to get a handle on the semantic problems. But The Myth of Mental Illness, he deals with those issues. Psychiatry, The Science of Lies is also a really good book. Look into that. And more recently, on some of these other problems with psychiatry and the diagnostic issues and the biology, Elliot Valenstein, PhD, is a psychological researcher, and he wrote a book called Blaming the Brain. And he goes into the very, very good pinpoint detail as to why these problems can't be illnesses or diseases. So it's Blaming the Brain. Robert Whittaker, of course, he's the scientific psychiatric journalist, and he's written a book called Anatomy of an Epidemic. It covers kind of the same stuff that Valenstein's book does. It's really good. And also one that I've started reading recently, it's pretty long, but it's really good. It's on schizophrenia specifically, and it's by Paris William, and he's a psychologist, Paris Williams, and the book is called Rethinking Madness. So that's going to be a really good one to read. And there's some more kind of peripheral. Anything by Foucault is pretty decent, although he was a hardcore statist, so I don't. And it's a little dated, but that's just some of the material.
Yeah, recently, I think Stefan Molyneux interviewed Robert Whittaker, right? And I just finished his interview on that, The Anatomy of an Epidemic. So that's pretty fascinating. But what I want to talk to you about, maybe this might be a bigger topic, but you know, I'm an acupuncturist and a Chinese herbalist. You know, that's what I went to college for. And so, you know, I have a bunch of books, you know, like, you know, acupuncture and Chinese, especially Chinese herbs, because that's more considered internal medicine. You know, there's a book just on like, you know, kidney problems. There's a book just on gynecology problems. There's a, like, it's like really complex stuff. And then there's another book that I have, which is just on psychological problems. And I got that because I was fascinated by it and I was reading through it. And it's very interesting because people ask me like, I have depression. What should I take? Right. And I guess that's the mindset that a psychiatrist would have. Like, you have depression, this is what you take. You have schizophrenia, this is what you take. It's like, you know, one to one. Whereas if somebody comes to me as a Chinese herbalist and says, I have depression, there is no one herb or herbal formula for that. It depends. Like, how are you sleeping? How's your energy level? Right? How's your emotional state? You know, how are you eating? How's your digestion? How's your bowel movement? All this stuff takes into account, and that is what we treat. Like, so basically, we don't really treat the depression. We don't treat you know, I don't know, bipolar. We don't treat that specifically. We treat everything else, because those are the constellation of signs and symptoms that are associated with that, which is kind of interesting, you know? So, So now, yeah, you just got me thinking about it, you know, when you were talking about this, like, so yeah, we don't really treat depression. We treat everything else that, you know, you can physically see, like the patient tells you, like, yeah, I have a poor appetite, you know, I'm fatigued and all this kind of stuff. So, yeah, so I'll add that in there. Maybe that could, you know, talk about that further, maybe in a later discussion.
Absolutely.
But yeah.
Interesting.
Yeah. I had that. I don't know if I ever shared that with you on the page or not.
Yeah, well, this is something I think is pertinent to this discussion or germane to the discussion. So the question, and Danilo sort of hinted on it, is the so what is the fix, you know, to issues of everyday problems, depression, and those kinds of issues. And one of the main problems that I see and that I think really help people get a grasp on this, because I'm going to move into another area of pharmacology, namely psychedelic compounds, plant teachers, and those types of remedies, which sadly are not talked about as much in relation to this subject, but I have to help to right. I have to help disabuse a couple of notions. And this is what I call people's drug schizophrenia, right? So I think that there are compounds that we can use, namely more natural, less synthetic compounds that can actually help people remedy any kind of issues they have. But here's what I mean by drug schizophrenia. People think that the psychiatric compounds are what they can use to heal them. They're legal. The psychiatrists wear the white coat, hand them out. So they're good in people's eyes, right? But so all these other compounds that are illegal, these natural chemicals, we have cannabis, psilocybin, you know, based on magic mushrooms, LSD. Here's the
ayahuasca.
Right, ayahuasca. Goes on Ibogaine, right? We can name them for days. But here's the major difference between these compounds and the psychiatric compounds. These compounds cause an intense, anomalous perceptive experience, or an intense, just what we call psychoactive experience that alters a person's subjective experience and allows them to look at their own life more objectively and to solve their own problems. Right? It facilitates deep introspection. Most of these compounds, we can talk about individual ones here in a moment, and the remedies that the quote-unquote remedy, the bits of snake oil that psychiatry is recommending, don't do anything near that. They're usually slow release, long-term compounds that slightly manipulate, serotonin reuptake in the SSRIs with depression, and so they're just slowly manipulating sort of these neurotransmission areas in the brain, or these different brain regions. But these other compounds immediately cause a psychedelic experience that allows people to introspect and think about their issues. And these other compounds don't offer that. And so what we're really trying to get at is a person, they want to really look at their lives. They want to be able to connect with other people, right? The emotional elements of it. Psychiatric compounds don't do that. Illegal plant teachers, they've been called entheogens, hallucinogens, etc. These compounds actually do what we want them to do, as far, and especially if you do them with people, and even MDMA, ecstasy, to an extent, will facilitate that process, dissolve boundaries, and allow a person to actually look at themselves with more objectivity. It's not this piddly shit that can possibly cause more problems and exacerbate anxieties and depressions over the long term. So that's I want to make clear and disabuse people of their drug schizophrenia. It's what I refer to as.
Yeah, I think that's very important, and it's, I mean, it seems to be trending in the direction that more and more people are becoming aware of that now. Thankfully, I mean MDMA, you were just mentioning. I mean, that one I think is that's being used for PTSD. I think, right? That's one of the one of the things that's being used for currently. But all of them, unfortunately, like you said, I mean, they've kind of joked about it, but it's true. They're considered taboo because they're quote unquote illegal. And because of their illegal status, especially here in the States, you know, research hasn't been quote, you know, allowed to be done on them. So nobody knows, although, you know, you look back in history and plenty of these things were used for, you know, hundreds of years to treat, you know, a myriad of different things. You know, and I'm somebody, you know, as far as like the psychoactive drugs, you know, I'm somebody I can speak from experience having done these. I mean, granted, it was in a recreational manner back then, but what you were, how you were describing the difference between, you know, what they do and what the legal drugs do. To me, it really just seems like the difference between the legal drugs are essentially shutting down parts of your brain or trying to encapsulate or just stop
something. Band-aid it.
Versus the psychedelics, which are actually opening your mind and giving you the opportunity, like you said, to get really deep introspective. Because even, you know, you can really have deep introspective moments. Like even back in my days when I was doing it recreationally, like I had some of my most profound thinking sessions, you know, just because like you said, the boundaries disappear. And like with MDMA, I know, you know, there's like sometimes a lot of that stuff, physical boundaries can disappear and people feel just more relaxed with each other and you can be more, you know, I mean, the joke with ecstasy is always everybody gets all lovey-dovey and stuff like that because you do, there's just these boundaries. But with the more psychoactive stuff, it's like the mental boundaries just disappear and you're able to just look at things how you would never, you can't possibly see a lot of these things with the naked eye or just your general perception of reality. It's impossible, you know, because there's just the color scale that, you know, we can't see most of the color scale. There's so much more out there that we have no idea about. And
Terrence McKenna called psychedelics a consciousness expander.
I mean, Terrence got a little nutty with some stuff, but I support that statement 100%. I mean, I can kind of get on board with the whole stoned ape theory, you know, like it's like,
it has air of plausibility.
Yeah. But you know, right. So like I said, I'm with you. I think that people definitely just need to be disabused of this notion and it really, you know, because there's the possibilities are at this point endless what actually can help people and in a more natural way. And that's not just saying just because it's natural it's good, but it's got to be a leg up automatically over the synthetic crap that they're just pumping into people's systems.
Right. Now, yeah, you drew in a lot of good points there. You're right. A lot of these, one of the first things you mentioned was a lot of the psychiatric drugs actually have a negative impact on our psychological functioning. Benzodiazepines, they often prescribe for anxiety, are tranquilizers, essentially. So they're going to put you out, stupefy you, zombify you, all of those.
Lithium, all those. Right. I did them all.
Right. Yeah, you were on the cocktail. Yep. Yeah, that's horrible, man.
Lithium, Thorazine, Trilofan, I think. That was another experimental one when I first took it. I've done a lot of those, unfortunately.
Right. Yeah, that's so.
We got a question. How do you feel about autism and Asperger's?
I'll go ahead and say right off the bat, I'm not, my knowledge as far as autism is concerned is not super, super great. It's not an area that I specialize in. I do feel like the neurodevelopmental issues, like autism specifically, is called a neurodevelopmental, disorder, quote unquote. These things are more in line with a neurodiversity, right? So people who have, especially children, of course, with autism have different viewpoints in regards to their socialization and toward dealing with people in society. And so there's an element of difference there. And actually, my little nephew, he was diagnosed autistic. And, you know, I always tell my cousin, and we talk about these issues, that is more like a gift to me. Autism is more like a gift. So one thing with autism, though, I won't immediately say like I do with the classical mental illnesses that it is de facto not an illness, because autism does seem to have some psychomotor issues that come along with it, some abdominal issues. That is very obviously an issue. So, you know, I hate putting the cart before the horse, which is what psychiatry does. The burden of proof is, of course, is on the people making the claim. But yep. I think there's clear observational evidence from just the physiological and psychomotor issues with autism that it would be an actual, quote unquote, real issue. But I say
the conspiracy theory that autism is caused by Monsanto fertilizers and foods. You know, pregnant mothers eat these foods, and then it affects the baby's mind.
I've heard the vaccine. No issues. Yeah,
I've heard multiple.
The vaccine one, I think the vaccine one. I think most people have heard, but
right.
I don't know.
I mean, I feel pretty confident that they have actually debunked the vaccine one in clinical trials and case studies. So, but again, I don't want to draw too much on the autism issue. I don't feel.
Okay, it was just somebody who was asking questions in chat.
Right. I see it down there. I'm looking at it, and that's the extent of my knowledge. I'm not an autism expert, but you know, the things like autism, the neurodevelopmental, and the neurodegenerative things like Alzheimer's to me is a clear disease. There's likely plaques in the brain cause it. So,
Let me interject real quick, because I actually treated a 16-year-old boy who had Tourette syndrome and Asperger syndrome, and he was he was pretty heavily medicated, and it was interesting, I didn't treat him with acupuncture. I treated him just with herbs, and this was all long distance. I never met the kid. I met him once, but everything was long distance over the phone call, doing follow-ups, and it was fascinating case, my most fascinating case. It took like so much copious amount of notes, and all handwritten, of course, but it was a really interesting case, because the mother was very skeptical of Chinese herbs, but she still let me try, and she still gave it to him, right? And they have like difficulty with textures, like food, and he also had like his body was temperature imbalance. So like as a child, he didn't feel cold, so he would go outside naked in the snow and like not cry or anything, just completely fine. Like it's amazing, like this kid, and he had these different tics, and they would transform different, spitting or just hitting people. He couldn't control it, and he would go to school and he would hold it in school. And then the mother said when he would come back from school, he would release all these tics. It would be like machine gun fire, that's the way she describes it. One after the other. It's really amazing. And I treated him with herbs for months, and the whole time, he was getting better. And she was like, nah, it's the weather, he's eating better, So she never credited the herbs that I was giving in. And then she's like, let's stop for a while. So we stopped for like, a few months, I guess. And then she's like, I don't know why, but these tics have been coming back. And so she wanted me to give it to him again. And so right when he took it, drastic decline. And she's like, oh my God. And I thought that was an amazing case. And the kid, it was very difficult to give it to him, because you can imagine he has a difficulty with eating, certain types of textures of food, and taking Chinese herbs was difficult. So I had to give in powders and capsules, that was even difficult, but I thought that was a really, really amazing case. I never treated anybody with Tourette's and Asperger's since then. That was my only case, but thought I'd share that.
That's pretty interesting. Cool.
Yeah. It's a really fascinating case.
That's amazing.
Right. Cool. I'd like to be, to be scientific about it, I'd like to see you replicate that with somebody else. But,
I tried to be as possible. I kept asking, are you sure? Are you sure?
I'm not discounting the fact that it may have actually helped, because I would think from in that regard it would be like a kind of an individual thing. I mean that may not have worked on somebody else who possibly is considered maybe further along the spectrum or not as far down the, I think there's a lot of variables there, but again, I'm not saying it didn't have an impact. I'm serious. I would like this. I hope you have the opportunity to, that's actually interesting. Cause we were talking about this earlier today, in a different forum. But the whole idea, like I have a little bit of knowledge about this, cause my baby mama, that's what she did for a long time. Before we met, after we were together, and then she's now actually just gone back to it. There's a lot of talk just in the people that do specialize in that area, that it's something that there is definitely something wrong, but it's a matter of there's just like different triggers that anything certain things could just set it off at any time, and that's why certain kids have it from, essentially from birth, and other ones it shows up later, which unfortunately ends up getting tied to, automatically getting tied to like things like vaccines and stuff like that, which again, it's not I don't think it's 100% conclusive that it's, you know, that it has no impact, because it could very well be a trigger in certain kids. But in other cases, it may just be a horrible coincidence. But it happens later because there's just these different triggers. So I mean, I would say, again, I don't have the experience or knowledge that you have in psychiatry or anything else in general. And I just have the little bit of knowledge I've gleaned off of her over the years. But I would agree with your, you know, layman's assessment that there's definitely a chance that there is something to this versus some of the other psychiatric stuff that's just kind of been thrown at people for years.
Right. Well, I mean, it's just such a clusterfuck because I can see part of it where these guys are really trying to be legitimate, and you know, a lot of psychiatrists really do want to help people who are suffering. So that, I mean, that's a definite given. But by the same token, the DSM obviously has been tainted in the past, right? When you've had things like homosexuality in there, when you have these very questionable, like compulsive type of disorders and things like that, ADD, ADHD, essentially, problems that look to me like subjective valuations about things that some people, behaviors that some people disagree with, maybe people in positions of power, even if it's on the school and the public education level with the whole ADHD phenomenon. So it's really a clusterfuck trying to discern what might have some type of legitimate merit. And this is why a lot of people are confused too. So trying to discern what might have legitimate merit as a potential illness, quote unquote, versus what is just something that somebody doesn't like. Because here's the thing with the DSM, and this is a fact Thomas Oz pointed out, is that these illnesses aren't discovered, right? They're not discovered like cancer or HIV infections, et cetera. They are voted on by psychiatrists in the ivory tower. They decide what the criteria is, what the diagnostic settings are. And then, of course, most mental illnesses you can't find on autopsy, right? Like you can find cancer on autopsy, infections, and a multitude of medical illnesses on the autopsy table in a corpse or a cadaver. That is not the same. It's not the same with mental illnesses, obviously. I can't find depression. If Danilo had died, I can't find his depression on his corpse.
let's just cut that little section out.
That depends if I was still married when I died. No.
Sterling, you have a question.
I know who I'm sending this one to first.
You have a question in chat. I'm gonna read it. What, if any, preconceived expectations does Sterling have regarding what his research will reveal when anarchistic principles are applied to talk therapy?
Yeah, so I can talk a little bit about this.
We're getting close to that hour. I'm just letting you know.
All right.
Okay, sure. Yeah. Well, just briefly then, what I'm going to attempt to do with this is work off the shoulders of giants, so to speak. Most psychological theories are built off of theories that are pre-existing. Right. So there's already one psychological theory that I believe has more of our principles and more of our ideas closer to heart. And I'm really glad you asked this individual asked this question because I wanted to talk about this. So my theoretical orientation in counseling is choice theory. And choice theory was developed by one William Glasser, Ph.D., back in the 60s. That's when it started. It started out as control theory, I believe, and it's advanced to choice theory and reality therapy. So his idea is real simple, that we're all self-responsible human beings and we are genetically encoded to meet basic needs. However, we can choose to meet our basic needs volitionally, right? And what we generally do as humans psychologically, we create what he called these quality world images in our mind. And this quality world images is the way that we see that we want our world to be. And so we go about trying to meet our needs and meet these quality world images through our choices, through our actionable behavior. And one of the really cool things about choice theory psychology is that Glasser had this idea that people are constantly trying to control each other. This is obvious. And he called it external control psychology. And it's the idea that we're constantly trying to subtly coerce each other, be petty tyrants, make people conform to our worldviews. And so we can meet this quality world picture. And so I foresee choice theory psychology mixed with existential psychology and my studies of neuroscience, especially recent neuroscience studies and how it's going to play into the field of counseling with ideas like neuroplasticity or changing brains, neurogenesis is the creation of new neurons, and how those activities work out in the counseling environment. So that's I hope that kind of answers the question. I'm trying to synthesize these different ideas in order to create essentially what I'm calling neuroliberty therapy as the platform for anarchist counseling. Does that kind of clarify it?
It seems very interesting.
Yeah, well,
I can't wait to hear more about it once you get a little more concrete, you know, a system and test and all that in place.
Right. I've got a the only counseling really that I've got to do is with you know, for training purposes and things like that. So until I actually probably a year and a half, I'll have my do the counseling, and I can actually start you know, practicing it in the way that I believe I should practice, as long as I'm adhering to their ethical mandates. But of course, I have the out with the whole feminist argument. I can use these ideas if they can use their social justice warrioring inside the counseling office. So, yeah.
Oh, I really like it.
And choice theory is awesome. I recommend anybody read his book. You guys would be really, you'd be like, that guy's talking about anarchism. But, you know, the thing about Glasser, he just didn't realize it when he was doing, when he was writing his work, he was, you know, he was pandering to government and didn't even realize it while talking about the problems with external control psychology. He didn't really realize that government is a force of external control psychology on all of us, right? But, yeah. I can sort of, I can say that it's okay, I guess, because he did put a good theory out there. It has good roots for me to work with, and there's good constructs and stuff. So I'll be able to build off of it, and I'm grateful for that. And all the theory hasn't really been worked with by a lot of people. Not a lot of counselors like it because it's considered a sort of you know, a lot of counselors are moving more toward these constructionist. And postmodern ideas of counseling, where it's based on like storytelling, and the client sort of they tell their story, and the counselor is basically this really objective observer and plays with their stories. It's a real phenomenological way of looking at counseling, is the way to put it, I guess, experiential. But and that's
my girlfriend's actually in college for counseling right now. That's.
What is she? I know we're limited on time. What's her theoretical orientation, or is she just doing? So she's doing counseling. So she must be doing her master's degree, right? Okay.
Right.
Cool.
Awesome.
This has been fascinating. I'm so glad we finally got you on here. I mean, I've been a big fan of your work, just in general, just your writings. You know, since I came across you a couple of years ago. You know, we've chatted every once in a while, but, this was really cool. I think this was a fascinating topic. I mean, obviously, like I said, I have my own personal, ideas about this, cause I've been on the inside of part of it, throughout my life.
Right.
But, I echo what Dave said. I mean, I'm really looking forward to following you and your work on this. Because the one thing you said very early on in the conversation, which really stuck with me, was the whole idea of like the cognitive dissonance thing. Just stick it, you know, that it just kind of blocks people, and it's the same thing here. So it's, you know, I think the fact that people like, you know, quote unquote us, you know, more logical thinkers, people have gotten over that hump already, have an advantage in that regard. And it could definitely be, I can't see why it wouldn't be helpful to be able to use that towards, you know, getting other people further along and possibly helping them versus just pumping them full of pills and stuff. So very exciting stuff, man. This has been great. Thank you very
Absolutely.
Much.
Absolutely. Hey, I appreciate you guys for having me. Very fun conversation. I really enjoyed speaking with you guys. So yeah.
Before we go, please plug your site and let people know where they can find you to follow your work.
Sure. So just come to Psychologic Anarchist, the Facebook page. You can just type in Psychologic Anarchist. And my blog and webpage is psychologic-anarchist.com. And you can also find me I work with the guys at The Art of Not Being Governed. I have for a long time before the Psychological Anarchist. So check us out at The Art of Not Being Governed and notbeinggoverned.com. So cool.
Very cool.
I really appreciate you coming on, Sterling. I've enjoyed just sitting back and listening to you explain this thing in detail, and it was really interesting. And I hope a lot of people really consider at least the cognitive dissonance that they're probably experiencing, hearing that depression is basically pseudoscience.
Right, and I'd be happy to speak with anybody about it. Well, you guys,
they can hit you up at Sterling Lujan on Twitter.
Indeed, Sterling Lujan on Facebook.
There you go.
Excellent. Well, magnificent conversation. Thank you very much, gentlemen. Thank you, Sterling. So if anybody wants to help us out, please do so. We accept Bitcoin and Patreon, patreon.com/seeds of liberty to help us out. We love doing this. We love having wonderful guests like Sterling here, and we want to do more. And we all know that comes with a cost. Nothing is free, right? No free lunch. So you want to help us out, give value for value. If you like our content, support us and make a little donation. It's the only democracy I support, right? Voting with your dollars. So thank you very much, gentlemen. Wonderful conversation. So this is The Seeds of Liberty. Wishing everyone have a wonderful day. Take care. Bye.
Peace.